Hey y'all, welcome to the show. It's my show, the show. The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org is my website. If you want to find the interview archives, the whole show archives, or if you want to hang out in the chat room, that's ScottHorton.org/chat. And, yeah, that's where I keep my stuff. Also, check out LRN.FM. That's the website of the Liberty Radio Network where I'm on. Today on the show, Dar Jamail will be on to do our weekly catch up on what the hell's going on in Iraq. And, also Jason Ditz will be on later on in the show to talk about Israel news. He's keeping track of everything at news.antiwar.com. So, find the latest on Israel's slaughter of the helpless Gazans. And, yeah, you know, I sent out so many invites yesterday. They all got answered. I did 5 interviews. This morning, I did not do nearly the work I should have. You know what? During the break, I'm going to try to call Dan. Maybe Dan. Nah, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I'll try to call Dan. He's been real busy writing his book on the abolition of nuclear weapons, but you may have seen the news. There's a blog entry about it at antiwar.com about billboards that have gone up all over Washington, D.C. with Daniel Ellsberg, who was vilified back when, but is now a folk hero among all decent and respectable people or something like that, for ending the Vietnam War, for helping to end it. And it says, don't do what I did. Don't wait until a new war has started. Don't wait until thousands more have died before you tell the truth with documents that reveal lies or crimes or internal projections of costs and dangers. You might save a war's worth of lives. Wow, I love Dan Ellsberg. Isn't he great? So there you go. And as you know, if you've ever heard Dan Ellsberg talk about his whistleblowing on this show before, and I've interviewed him a hell of a lot of times about it, you know that, I mean, this is very personal. This rhetoric is very personal on his part. He's, you know, let's see, not just crimes, but lies, too. Misrepresentations. And, you know, if you can prove that, that's important. If you can prove the internal projections of costs and dangers. These are the kinds of things, if you know Dan Ellsberg's story, he was first an officer in the Marines killing people over in Vietnam going back to 1961. And he knew that the war was a lost cause then. Never mind morality, he just knew it could not work. Would not, absolutely would not, could not, quote unquote, work. And he kept that to himself, or he, you know, worked within the system and all of that crap for almost, what, 10 more years, right? Before he finally said, that's it, I'm leaking the Pentagon Papers. And, in fact, one time on this show, the man damn near was crying about it, talking about how millions of people died and it was his damn fault. And the fact that it was his damn fault was proven by the fact that look what he was able to do about it when he finally decided to do something about it. And he could have done something about it from the very beginning. And so even though we regard him as a hero, he regards himself as history's greatest villain for waiting so long to tell the people the truth that these generals are out of control. The government is out of control. This Vietnam War project, the worst thing happening on the planet at the time, is corrupt and bankrupt from the very beginning, even as an idea, even as a concept, a strategy, a pile of tactics for use in the Cold War with the Soviets and the Chinese and the whatever. The whole thing, just forget it. He knew all along. And that's what this is from. You know, if you have official estimates of what might really happen if America was to follow X certain horrible policy they're contemplating, the people have a right to know. And if you think they're going to go ahead and they're going to do the horrible thing anyway, you've got to do what it takes to try to stop them. That is your moral responsibility to the people of the country. Who, you know, if you believe the Constitution, the people constitute this government, allow it to exist to protect their security. That's it. They're not our overlords. Well, they are, but I'm saying the concept is they work for us. And, you know, it's just like Edward Snowden. You hear these liberals. It's funny, I got banned on Twitter by some liberal for saying, hey, listen, Snowden going through the process is a red herring. The process is what was corrupt. If it had been his, co-cubicle mate was just abusing the technology to make business deals on the side or spy on his ex-wife and persecute her or whatever. Well, that's the kind of thing where, yeah, you go through the chain of command. Hey, boss, guess what's happening kind of thing. But when your boss, the director of the National Security Agency, is the criminal and his co-conspirator is the president and the whole thing is blessed by the intelligence agencies, who's he supposed to blow the whistle to? They are the ones. The law itself is the crime. The highest level bosses in the government are the ones who are culpable. The whistle has to be blown to the American people about what these most powerful so-called authority figures are up to. See how that works? Oh, you're blocked. You're blocked for your ad hominem attack, kook. Okay. Guess that's how it goes. Anyway, Dan Ellsberg, the American hero, they're putting up exposefacts.org. They have the secure drop, a WikiLeaks like encrypted drop off point, so that government officials, they don't have to be like Snowden and go to Hong Kong and spill their whole guts and give an interview on camera to Greenwald and Poitras. None of that's required. All they got to do is anonymously upload the documents, and journalists will take it from there. Tell the truth. You don't have to get the Manning treatment. Manning spilled her entire guts to a low-down, dirty, stinking rat. Left an entire chat log about every single thing that she did to a filthy rat who then turned it over to the government. But you don't have to do that. Edward Snowden said, I want to be interviewed on camera by Laura Poitras and Glenn Greenwald and explain why it is I did what I did so that people will know. So the government won't be able to call me a traitor before the people have a chance to hear me tell them that I did it for them. And I mean it. You don't have to do that. You just anonymously upload via Secure Drop to the Freedom of the Press Foundation, which includes on its board of directors Edward Snowden, Daniel Ellsberg, Glenn Greenwald, Trevor Tim. Am I making myself clear? And that's at Expose Facts, their new project, Expose Facts. And here's Daniel Ellsberg saying, hey man, your obligation is to the people of the country. If your government department is involved in criminal activity, or activity that the American people certainly need to know about so that it can be checked, then do the right thing. Tell the truth. And they're putting these signs up. I love this. Billboards all over Washington, D.C. You know, the consensus that, hey, everybody knows that what's going on here is totally legitimate is very powerful. And you start, you know, putting major cracks in that, walls can start tumbling down pretty quick. And, you know, it's just a fact of life. George Carlin couldn't live forever, but we all have a duty to expose these hypocrisies and to show that the government is in the wrong and does not deserve the benefit of the doubt or impunity for their crimes. Right? Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Hey, Fitzy in the chat room is throwing in here as a parenthesis, apropos to my Manning rant there, that the rat, Adrian Lamo, tried to lure Manning into turning to the dark side and selling his secrets rather than exposing them. And Manning, of course, explains to the rat over and over again, no, 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 I want the people to know the truth so that they can use their democratic processes so as to make reforms, to make the world a better place. So, what do you mean, sell it to Russia? I don't want money, and I don't want the Russians to have it. What are you talking about? Adrian Lamo, the filthy rat, failed in his attempt to entrap Manning into doing anything immoral. With the documents, of course. And by the way, spent some time looking through the Iraq and Afghan war logs and the State Department cables. For that matter, the Guantanamo documents that Manning leaked as well. But especially those Iraq and Afghan war logs, there's so much in there. And there's so much that's been reported out of there. I don't know. Can you give a Pulitzer to the source? I don't know. Whatever prize. Manning should get all the prizes. To this day, stories are being reported that say, according to leaked State Department diplomatic cables, we provide this context to the story that we're reporting to you now. That goes on every week. I don't know if anybody's counted them all, but there are 10,000 stories or 50,000 stories. I don't know. That cite Manning's leak. Documents from those leaks. Important journalism to the 100th power. Done over and over and over again, thanks to the heroic Chelsea Manning. Rotting in prison for 35 years. For doing the right thing. All right, anyway. So listen, a lot to talk about. Dick Cheney, I think it's just great that the Cheneys... In fact, I was mocking the Weekly Standard earlier. I think maybe I shouldn't have done it. I was actually, I was mocking them, but I was really giving them advice. It's really stupid of them to just keep putting Dick Cheney and Liz Cheney out front to make the case. Now, these two apparently are just not satisfied with any other voice getting the job done, so they can't help themselves. Somebody, some Karl Rove somewhere has got to be telling them that Americans hate you, and they blame you for all of this, and you're not going to be able to talk them out of this, and if you want America to go back to war, you should shut up about it and let somebody else make the case, because all you're doing is making the case that it's wrong to be for war, you stupid, evil, murderer bastards, you. Now, maybe Dick Cheney really is brilliant. And what he really wants is to keep America out of war right now. And to that end, he's the one putting himself forward to make the case. But in fact, I think it's just imperial hubris. We gotta listen to him, because he knows everything, what to do, better than you, better than everyone. Just ask him. He'll tell you. And anyway, so here he is again, Dick and Liz Cheney. In the Weekly Standard, and they start off saying, okay, now that we got the caliphate, it is wrong for any of these other neocons, like even Bill Kristol in the Weekly Standard, to say that we shouldn't go back and relitigate the war. We should just move on with what's going on now. He says, no, let's relitigate it. So I say, okay, let's do that. Let's relitigate the war, Dick Cheney. He says, well, you're essentially saying we'd be better off if Saddam Hussein was in power. A position difficult, he says, to sustain. And then, so what's his argument against that? Saddam had deep, long-standing, far-reaching relationships with terrorist organizations, including Al-Qaeda and its affiliates. No, he didn't. That's a bunch of crap, and everybody knows that's a bunch of crap. And all he did was provide, he would give money to the families of any Palestinians killed by the Israelis or in conflict with the Israelis, which also included any suicide bombers, too. Bad PR on Saddam Hussein's part? Sure. Does that make him part of an organized terrorist offensive with Osama bin Laden against the United States? No. And of course, as we were talking about the other day, he offered to switch sides in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Just like the Iranians in 2003, they were just copying Saddam in 2002, saying, I'll sell out the Palestinians in no time, man, just don't kill me. When Richard Pearl said to Saddam's henchmen, tell Saddam we'll see him in Baghdad. Surrender will never be good enough for us on any of this. And it's just a lie that Saddam was buds with Osama. And just like I told you in 2001 and 2002 and 2003, it's a lie before the war. Hey, you notice how one's got a clean shave on his chin and the other one don't? That's actually meaningful, okay? You see how one's wearing olive green and a beret and the other one's wearing a robe? And you see how one of them is in Mesopotamia and the other one is 1,500 miles east of there on the far side of Iran, on the Afghan-Pakistan border. You see how these guys just ain't the same? You see how before the war, Osama urged the people of Iraq to rise up against the socialist infidel, Saddam Hussein. Oh, take no mention of the fact that these guys are sworn enemies. That the best connection these guys, the Cheneyites, could ever come up with. Oh, here he goes. He cites Zarqawi. Listen to this liar. Here, I don't even have to put words in his mouth. Here they come. Dick Cheney in the Weekly Standard. Ansar al-Islam, an al-Qaeda-linked organization, operated training camps in northern Iraq before the invasion. Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the future leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq, funneled weapons and fighters into these camps before the invasion from his location in Baghdad. We also know, again, confirmed in documents captured after the war, that Saddam provided funding, training, and other support to numerous terrorist organizations and individuals over the years, including to Zawahiri, the man who leads al-Qaeda today. What a lie. Give me a break. All right, so what a pile of lies. Let's go, rewind a minute. First of all, Ansar al-Islam, an al-Qaeda-linked organization, operated training camps in northern Iraq. Yeah, in autonomous Kurdistan, protected by the United States, no-fly zone, from Saddam Hussein. You can read Jim McLeshesky from NBC News and 1,000 other reporters all about how the military begged George Bush for permission to attack Zarqawi, who was not in Baghdad, getting a peg leg from Saddam Hussein, like in the neocon lie propaganda that Dick Cheney is attempting to regurgitate here. He was with his group, Ansar al-Islam, in Kurdistan, safe in protected autonomous American Iraq before the war. And Colin Powell cited Zarqawi as the link between Saddam and Osama in his UN speech, even though Zarqawi had told Osama to go to hell. I don't want to fight America. I want to fight the King of Jordan. And even though Saddam Hussein had an all points bulletin out on this guy, a death mark out on his head. And of course, when Cheney says he's the future leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq, what he means is it wasn't until 2 years into the war that Zarqawi finally declared his loyalty to al-Qaeda. We're just beginning deconstructing the lies in Dick Cheney's New Weekly Standard piece here. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy. The OffNow project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work. if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. All right, y'all, welcome back. So, you know, I really blew it up, man, here. I screwed it up. I didn't dispute his original premise, Dick and Liz Cheney's original premise here, that to say that they should not have gone to war in 2003 is to say the Middle East, Iraq, would be better off with Saddam Hussein. Of course, that's true, indisputably true, but it's not necessary. It's not a necessary argument. You could say that a lot of the world would be a lot better off without the horrible governments they suffer under. None of that translates directly into authority for the U.S. government to launch an aggressive war and kill hundreds of thousands of people in order to change those governments. They just tried to slip that one past us, and, well, it worked on me for a second there. Not that I was necessarily buying it, but I didn't stop to confront that argument anyway. So he says, oh, if you're against the war, then you love Saddam, something like that, and that's just ridiculous. But of course, it is undisputably true that the million-something dead people would be better off alive if America hadn't gotten them killed. That the bin Ladenite jihadi movement across the Middle East right now wouldn't even exist whatsoever if it hadn't have been for that war to overthrow Saddam. Wouldn't exist if he was there now to crush it. Wouldn't have ever even cropped up in the first place. And again, Zarqawi was up. If you're not familiar, after the first Gulf War, George Bush Sr. urged the Shia and the Kurds to rise up and overthrow Saddam. Then he changed his mind and decided actually rather keep Saddam. And So then he just let Saddam kill them all with his attack helicopters and with his Mujahideen e-call communist terrorist cult, especially against the Kurds. The MEK was used. And then so after that, they declared the no-fly zones. That was where they bombed Iraq throughout the entire Clinton years, in the no-fly zones. But in the north, it was also a no-drive zone. The Iraqi government was banned from the north completely. It's been autonomous Kurdistan since 1991. So when Dick Cheney goes, oh, yeah, Zarqawi was in northern Iraq. Yeah, northern Iraq. In other words, America. He was in America, protected by Dick Cheney, so he could be used as a talking point. You can read Jim Mikleshensky at NBC News, and 100 other people followed up on this. That the Pentagon begged the government to go in there, the Bush-Cheney civilian government, to go in there and kill Zarqawi before the war. Because if once we overthrow Saddam and turn the whole country to chaos and lose track of this Zarqawi guy, he could be really dangerous to our soldiers, you know? Yeah, yeah. And then it was at the end of 2004, December of 2004, after America had already occupied Iraq, invaded and occupied for a year and 9 months before Zarqawi finally declared himself loyal to bin Laden. As Cheney's put it here, Zarqawi, the future leader of al-Qaeda. Yeah, he wasn't al-Qaeda until Dick Cheney made it that way with his war. And then as far as Saddam's support, supposedly out of the documents proving that he gave money to Ayman al-Zawahiri, I've never heard that before in my life. I refute it by saying, show me the proof of that. He doesn't cite any footnote or anywhere that anyone can follow up on that. Maybe he's referring to Stephen, what's his name, who got everything wrong in the Weekly Standard about all the ties. Case closed. The ties between Saddam and Osama completely refuted and destroyed by Michael Scheuer, the former chief of the CIA's bin Laden unit, who said, no, boy, sit down and shut up because you don't know what you're talking about. But anyway, and then Cheney's continue here. It's also undisputed that Hussein had the technology, equipment, facilities, and scientists in place to construct the world's worst weapons. No. It is not undisputed that at all. He had nothing. He had no nuclear program of any description whatsoever. Oh, he intended to reconstitute these programs as soon as the international sanctions regime collapsed. Nonsense. The UN quit looking for weapons in 1995 when they knew that they were done. All their questions were answered. The only thing left were the remainders, the errors in the paperwork, the shells that had been shot at test ranges but hadn't been accounted for, or whatever. The whole thing was over. Any nuclear material in the country was under IAEA lock and key. There were no centrifuges. There was no nothing. The Cheneys even have the gall in this article to say, Saddam had an advanced nuclear program in place prior to Operation Desert Storm in 1991. Yeah, so what? He didn't have it after 1991, which, as we can all do on our fingers here real quick, was 12 years before this war. Your excuse had expired 12 years before. See, they were just lying when they called Saddam Hussein a nuclear weapons threat in 1990 to get you to support Operation Yellow Ribbon, and then it only turned out that they were accidentally telling the truth. They didn't know that he really did have a secret nuclear weapons program, not that he was light years, within actually having enough weapons-grade material for a bomb. But anyway, the Cheneys just dropped that in there. Oh, yeah, Saddam Hussein had a nuclear program back in 1991. Yeah? So what? In 98, he kicked the international weapons inspectors out of Iraq. Damned lie. Bill Clinton pulled the inspectors out of Iraq when he wanted to do Operation Don't Impeach Me because I'm going to launch a bunch of missiles at Iraq on the day that the House is to begin debating the articles of impeachment. Not that anybody could see through that or anything. And not that anybody can see through Cheney claiming otherwise now. It was the day the full House was to begin debating the articles of impeachment that Bill Clinton launched Operation Desert Fox, which he named after Erwin Rommel, the Nazi. Oh, and people say, Rommel wasn't a Nazi. Oh, yeah, no, he just served Hitler on his knees. But other than that, he wasn't a Nazi. Yeah, well, anyway, so Bill Clinton named his Operation Desert Fox after Erwin Rommel, the Nazi. In order to not be removed from office. Not that he was really under threat of being removed, but anyway. And then he violated every one of the 17 UN Security Council resolutions passed against him. Again, another completely ridiculous assertion. Not just unproven, but they don't even explain what they mean by that. Dick and Liz Cheney here. He didn't have mustard gas. He didn't have warehouses full of VX and sarin and mustard gas. And he didn't have mobile biological weapons labs for making anthrax. And he didn't have a nuclear program at all. And so what Security Council resolutions was he in violation of when they passed 1441 in the fall of 2002? Saddam said, fine. Speaking of bending right over, he got down on his knees and said, go ahead. They searched the whole country. They couldn't find anything. By the time it was March 2003, it was so obvious. The politics were, geez, if we let the conspectors keep running around for weeks on end without being able to find anything much longer, we're not going to be able to have a war. It's going to be a proven fact that he really doesn't have anything. And so before we get to, holy crap, you can't even argue it anymore. There just is nothing to find. Let's go ahead and launch the war now. It was as simple as that. Even the godforsaken liberals with their horrible half-assedness saying, give the inspectors more time. If they had only gotten more time, they couldn't have launched the war. That was why they started it when they started it. Was, well, you know what? He's not coming forward with the weapons that we accuse him of having, and so that's the proof that he's still hiding them. Blah, blah, blah. And then he brings up Saddam in 88, the attack on Halabja. Funny, he leaves out the Anfal campaign, but of course, that was when he worked for Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush and the Republicans. Dick Cheney was in Congress at the time as a member of the Republican Party. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, y'all. So I'm taking too long to get through this, and it's because I haven't even read it yet. I'm just going through it with you here. It's Dick Cheney and Liz Cheney in the Weekly Standard saying, oh, yeah, you want to relitigate the Iraq War? Let's fight then. And so I'm trying to take them up on it. So now I'm at the part where they cite Saddam's use of chemical weapons against the Kurds. But of course, that was when America supported Saddam in the war against Iran. And yes, it's true, they also sold weapons to Iran for use against Iraq. But that was George H.W. Bush and Ronald Reagan who supported Saddam at that time. And there was just a report out, I guess almost a year ago now, at Foreign Policy, where they go through Better Than Ever. And everybody's known this all along, by the way. It's been reported in, you know, Newsweek and whatever kind of official stuff all along. But further confirmation than ever before came out just in the last year at foreignpolicy.com about how America, the Republicans, helped Saddam Hussein target the Iranians with chemical weapons. And, you know, one of the Kurdish factions had sided with the Iranians in the war. I'm not justifying any of it. I'm just saying for then the Republicans, Dick Cheney, who, or I guess he was in the Congress again at the time, when George H.W. Bush became president, he became the Secretary of Defense. And I guess they supported Saddam up until the summer of 1990. He was sworn in 89, so I don't know. Somebody look in and report that. All Dick Cheney's contact with Iraq in the year 1989 and in the spring of 1990. The Defense Department's relationship with Iraq right then in the George H.W. Bush years, but before Operation Yellow Ribbon. And anyway, they were backing him when he was using poison gas. And for the Cheneys to claim that poison gas is the world's worst weapons is just a damn lie. Atomic bombs and hydrogen bombs are the world's worst weapons. City killers. And yes, I guess it's technically, you know, imaginable that someone could create a super virus that would wipe out millions or something like that. But to say WMD is to lie right to people's face in the first place, and to try to conflate mustard gas or sarin gas with a damned atom bomb, which could blow up your whole town. Whole town. And I'm talking to you, people who live in Houston, Texas, the fourth largest city in history. Could blow up one of your Houston-sized cities. Some of these tens of megaton-sized ones. And anyway, and yeah, they got them. So to conflate some mustard gas with H-bombs is just stupid. They're trying to fool you in the first place there. And again, they're saying when the DOD helped Saddam target Iran with chemical weapons during that war. And then he wants to cite rape rooms when Dick Cheney is the one, as we all know, who led the charge and aligned the lawyers to legalize torture, to legalize torturing Iraqis, to treat anyone that they targeted in Iraq as an illegal enemy combatant terrorist rather than any kind of prisoner of war or any other thing. Take off the gloves. Grab whom you must. Do what you want. The rules of torture at Guantanamo and the rules of torture of Afghanistan were imported into the Iraq War, most notoriously at the Abu Ghraib prison, but really all over the place. Go look at Tony Lugaranis. I know it's not too easy to spell, but I don't know, sound it out. Lugaranis, the torture question at PBS. And he's just one, you know. Ian Fishback told the same story. A lot of other whistleblowers all across Iraq told the same story. They tortured Iraqis in their own homes. They tortured them in their front yard. They tortured them in their backyard. They tortured them on the side of the road. They tortured them too. They tortured them fro. And they tortured them by the tens of thousands. Including, yeah, raping them including, yeah, at Abu Ghraib, raping their kids. And then Dick Cheney's going to talk to you and me about Saddam Hussein's rape rooms, when, again, everybody knows the Republicans supported him all along until they stabbed him in the back. He didn't stab us in the back. America stabbed him in the back. And then they came and made everything worse. And they installed the Maliki regime, which is from the Dawa Party, which runs the Bada Brigade now, which is they torture people to death with power drills, man. Your worst nightmare. That's how they do business in Iraq now, under the Shia Saddam, as they call him, Nouri al-Maliki. And Dick Cheney's going to talk about Saddam's rape rooms, leaving him in power. Again, just it's assumed that this is up to America to start aggressive wars whenever they feel like changing a regime. It's a matter of leaving someone in power to not invade them, the way they frame it here. And then he just goes back and cites a bunch of bogus intelligence, and he cites a bunch of damned Democrats, John Kerry, Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, Nancy Pelosi, and Bill Clinton, saying, yeah, Saddam's really bad. Like, that proves anything. You're telling me Bill Clinton, the liar, saying something is true is what proves it's true? No. I'm sorry. You're telling me John Kerry, the biggest laughingstock in the world, who lost an election to George W. Bush? Joe Biden, need I elaborate? These people agreed with Dick Cheney, and that's what proves that he was right. Nancy Pelosi and Bill Clinton. And meanwhile, of course, the real answer is America should not be backing revolutions, should not be doing regime changes, should not be supporting dictatorships either. But as far as even if you were a Republican, but you weren't absolutely stupid, what would have been the smart thing to do would have been to send Donald Rumsfeld back over there to shake hands with Saddam Hussein again, not to supply him with chemical weapon precursors like Ronald Reagan did under the guise of farm loans, but to tell him, listen, we won't kill you. We'll let you stay in power, but you got to kill bin Ladenites. Any of these jihadi type guys crop up around here, you kill them. And if we catch you slipping, then we're going to have a problem. Now, you want to be friends again? And, of course, Saddam already was saying, please, let's be friends again. Please don't kill me. You can read it in the New York Times. You know, one time I was riding with some family, and they were trying to figure out why I was just so obsessed with the Iraq war thing. And I was trying to explain just how they lied us into war so badly and all this crap. And then we stopped for barbecue, and this would have been in 2003. Maybe 2004, but I think 2003, still the first year of the war. And there it was on the front page of the Austin American-Statesman, a reprinted New York Times article, I would guess now it must have been by James Risen or something. And it was about how Richard Pearl had met Saddam Hussein's lackey in London, and Saddam Hussein's lackey had promised to give up everything. He said, you can send in the army, the CIA, and the FBI to search wherever you want for weapons of mass destruction. You have carte blanche. I'll switch sides in the Israel-Palestinian conflict. I'll tell Hamas and Hezbollah, you better disarm and become political parties. He said, you want to talk about oil? Let's talk about oil and mineral rights. Somebody said something about democracy. I'll hold elections. You can let international monitors come and administer them and guarantee their fairness. Richard Pearl told Saddam's lackey, you tell Saddam, we'll see you in Baghdad. Absolute and total capitulation will never be good enough for us. And just go back and check George W. Bush's line in the 48-hour speech. You have 48 hours to leave Iraq with your sons, not or else, and we're invading anyway, no matter what. That was the speech. Anyway, he goes on to cite the neocons got Bill Clinton to sign the Iraq Liberation Act, which Ron Paul said at the time, this is just a future declaration of war. Later on, they're going to cite this as proof that it's a bipartisan policy. You mark my words. That was Ron Paul in 1998. Here they lie and claim that Gaddafi was convinced to capitulate to America after the invasion of Iraq. Every single talking point lie they ever came up with is in this article here. And of course, that's just not true. Gaddafi had been trying to suck up to the West since 1996. Gary Hart wrote an article all about it in the New York Times Magazine. And the only reason Gaddafi bought any of that crap from AQ Khan was just so he could turn it over to America. He wasn't making nukes with it. He wouldn't do anything with it. And so there's another lie. And then they turn around and I guess in the Obama years, they stabbed Gaddafi in the back there. Although it was Robert Gates who helped do it. So there's, you know, kind of a continuity there. And then they go on to lie about the surge and say the surge worked, when all the surge did was prove that Dick Cheney's strategy was flawed completely. The insurgency was not in its last throes. Not at all. It had to be bribed and bought off. It was George Bush who was won over in the surge to quit fighting the resistance. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. darrenscoffee.com. All right, y'all. Well, I guess I should have called and left him on hold. His Skype symbol went from green to green outline. Where are you, Dar? All right, well, hell, let me email him back here. We had an email thing going here earlier. Where are you? Where'd you go? From me to you. All right, well, anyway, we're going to talk with Darge Mail here in a minute because I just told him I'll spare you the commercials and call you in a few, and then he went away. He said, okay, and then he went away. Oh, there he is again. Well, I don't know. Well, that's strange. Let's see. Try to call me. Because I sure can't call you, dude. All right. Well, so Darge Mail. Oh, yeah. It's working. I don't know.
Hey, Scott.
Hey, how's it going, man?
Good.
Good, good. I don't know what was the problem. Your symbol was all paled out, and so it would only let me call phone, not call Skype call. Anyway, So I'm glad it worked the other direction, though. Everybody, introducing Darge Mail. He is formerly an unembedded Iraq War reporter, author of Beyond the Green Zone and The Will to Resist, and now he writes primarily about environmental stuff for America.AlJazeera.com. Is there anything important I left out there, Dar?
Yeah, actually, no, I don't work for Al Jazeera anymore. I'm writing for truthout.org.
Oh, you know what? I knew that and forgot it. Thank you for correcting me on that. Truthout.org.
Yeah, and I do have actually a big article I've been working on about the situation in Iraq that we're going to publish both with Truthout and Tom Englehart this coming Tuesday.
Oh, great. Well, good. That means we can run it as an original on antiwar.com as a Tom article.
Yeah.
Perfect. Okay, good. So, yeah, listen, well, tell me all about it. I don't know where to begin. There's so much news to cover. There's larger context to cover. You can rewind as far back as you want. You can talk about Dick Cheney's new article in the Weekly Standard. Say whatever you want about Iraq, Dar. Go ahead.
I know, throw a dart, right? Well, you know, clearly the big news today is really the Kurds, the opportunistic Kurds taking full advantage of the situation, taking control of two more of Iraq's oil fields, and of course the assault against them in Baghdad by Maliki continues, which is of course worsening the situation, and I'm sure spurring the Kurds to even just take it further. The Maliki regime, this just came out that they are replacing Iraq's foreign minister Hoshyar Sabari because he's Kurdish. Apparently that's the most likely reason. So he's being removed. And, you know, of course, we saw Maliki recently accuse the Kurds of working in tandem with ISIS and collaborating with them. So, it's a full-on war
On that last
internally.
point, Dar, is that just a talking point, or do you think there's something to that? I mean, they certainly took advantage of the situation to go ahead and lock down Kirkuk finally, right?
Yeah, they certainly took advantage of the situation. I don't think there's anything behind it. I think it's Maliki just basically being embattled and behaving accordingly and making threats that, of course, he can't back up because he basically doesn't have a functional military. So it's just part and parcel of the internal political disaster that is Iraq. I mean, people wondering, well, why is the Iraqi government dithering while the country's literally in a state of full-on disintegration? They, after, less than a week ago, they had announced they were going to take a 5-week break in parliament before they met again. And then, probably under intense U.S. pressure, among other sources of pressure, decided, okay, well, we're going to meet again in just a few more days from today. And so it's in a state of total meltdown. But, as I think we've talked about this years ago, Scott, is when the U.S. set up this government and this parliamentary system, they set it up so that it really couldn't be truly united and really have an Iraq that would stand on its own, because the first thing that would happen if we had a real democratic government reflective of the will of the majority of the Iraqi people, all ties with the U.S. would be immediately cut for the
Right.
disaster they created. So they'd set up a quisling government that is doing exactly what it can do today, which is just fight amongst itself and disintegrate. And the more pressure you apply internally and externally to what's going on in the country, the less effective that government becomes. And that's why we see them being completely ineffective. And then one of the offshoots of that is, who in the military is going to fight for a government that can't even meet in the same room together, let alone pretend to reflect the will of the Iraqi people? It's just not going to happen.
Yeah. Well, and so is Maliki just lashing out at this point? I mean, it seems like I'm trying to pretend I'm him for a minute. Go ahead and deal with ISIS first. It's been the Shia Kurdish coalition against the Sunnis all along. You would think that it would be even more so now that the enemy is this Baghdadi guy rather than their local tribal chiefs they're used to dealing with, right? Why would he be so insistent on picking a fight with the Kurds now? I guess they're insistent that he leave, so that could be part of it.
Yeah, it's all of the above. I mean, it's certainly the Kurds are coming after him because they've been at odds for years. We talked, I think, last week on your show about how, it was just a few years ago that Maliki rolled a lot of the Iraqi army up to the border of Kurdistan and threatened to invade when the Kurds were starting to make some of their initial moves at making their oil deals independent of Baghdad. And so, they make their moves. Maliki responds with threats and other overt gestures, and then that makes things worse. And so it goes, chicken or the egg, who started it, whatever, it doesn't even matter at this point. We've got basically an internal war politically between Maliki and the Kurds, and at this point, basically between Maliki and everyone else. And he's under intense pressure to step aside. Sistani has basically called for him to step aside, which, basically in Iraq, if you're a Shia, is an edict from God. Not even to talk about the intense pressure he's under now, even from DC. So he's embattled and he's in a corner. He's like a wolverine in a corner, and he's lashing out at anybody and anything that he perceives as a threat, which is just about everybody at this point.
Well, and I guess it took a while for me to really get this through my head, Dar, but from what I understand from talking with Patrick Coburn and Mitchell Prothero, there really is no Iraqi army. I mean, he has his special forces, Wolf Brigade, SWAT teams, special forces teams that America made for him there that are directly answerable to him. But I guess I just had kind of imagined in my mind's eye that, of course, they fell back from Mosul into Crete and the predominantly Sunni cities where they didn't really have any support, or they fell back to Shia-controlled territory. But no, they kept falling back until they didn't exist anymore. There is no Iraqi army anymore. It's just the Shiite militias. Is that your understanding of this?
Yeah, that's what I'm seeing too, which is a huge problem. I mean, as Iraq, I mean, we could say it's in a descent into sectarianism, but we're so far down into that descent already. That makes it sound as though it's in the future when it's not. And
Yeah,
that's
but it
certainly what
does
I'm
make it
hearing
that
too.
much harder to compromise later when it's the solderists and the solder and bodder doing the fighting for the Shia. Makes it, they are sectarian militias by definition, and so it makes the war a sectarian war. Or at least if it's the Iraqi army, you could pretend that someday this could be, you know, we'll finally meet those benchmarks of 2007 and integrate the Sunnis into it or something. Ain't no integrating the Sunnis into the Badr Brigade.
That's exactly right. No, all that is spot on. I totally agree with it, and that's what I'm seeing, and that's what I'm hearing from my sources in Baghdad, Fallujah, et cetera. And, of course, all of that is only making the situation worse because it's all these same militias that were the U.S. brought into Fallujah during the mopping up after the 2004 sieges and left these guys in control of Fallujah to go in and do home raids and carry out other horrible things for the so-called government. And so it's just more fuel on the fire. And at the end of the day, you know, I mean, one of the voices I include in this article I have coming out next week is a contact of mine in Baghdad who and his wife and their small children live in a predominantly Sunni area of Baghdad. And he's like, look, we're terrified. This is worse than we've seen ever, even worse than the 2006, 2007 sectarian bloodletting, and we just don't know what to do.
You know, we're going to pick it up right there on the other side of this break. It's the heroic Dar Jamail, everybody, talking about the sad situation in Iraq. Give us 4 minutes.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Dar Jamail. He's got a new one coming out for truthout.org about Iraq. I'm looking at one from Hannah Alam in McClatchy newspapers today. Sunnis sending their sons abroad as fear of sectarian killings escalates in Baghdad. We say 85% Shiite city now, thanks to George W. Bush and the U.S. Army and Marine Corps and Air Force and Navy and CIA and Blackwater. But that still means there's 15% Sunnis here, there, and in isolated neighborhoods in and around Baghdad, and that was where we ended at the break. You're saying that some of your sources are telling you the level of the climate of fear is worse than 2006? How could that even be?
That's right, because he said what he's seeing there on the ground right now is quote-unquote government forces, you know, in the quotes because of how we just defined them earlier in the program, the quote-unquote government slash Shia militia forces are going around into Sunni neighborhoods now and carrying out large amounts of home raids, as they did back in 06 and 07. And then in the days following these home raids, the people that go missing are turning up in various Baghdad morgues or not turning up at all. So this is part and parcel to what we saw in 06 and 07, minus maybe they're not piling the heads or body parts in the streets as terrorism, but they're just either being disappeared or just straight out killed, and the bodies are being dumped off at the morgue. So that's happening. And he said what we're also seeing is people are in a panic, and people just want out of Baghdad. They're obviously seeing this going on. You know, you don't know when your house is going to be next, so they just want to get the hell out. So, but they don't know where to go because there's fighting literally all to the east, west, and north of Baghdad. And of course, if you go south, you're going straight down into where the Shia militias are in total control of everything. So he said, we don't know where to go. And even if we did, to try to get even a bus ticket, there's month-long waits now to get bus tickets that are now so expensive that half the people can't afford them anyway. And he said that's the situation. They're literally living in these various enclaves of Baghdad, terrified.
Man. Well, and I guess the same is probably true for the Shia up in Mosul and wherever else, too. And, again, the legacy of Bush's invasion. One thing about ISIS, according to Patrick Coburn, the way he puts it, and I don't see anybody else really emphasizing this that much, although maybe I'm just not looking in the right places, but Coburn says that to ISIS, the Shia occupy the same place that Jews did to the fascists of Europe in the 30s. They are the ultimate scapegoat, blasphemer, enemy, internal, enemy, external, whatever. Kill them all. All of them. America versus the Red Indian style. They're the only good Shia is a dead Shia. The worst, absolute worst sort of chauvinism against the Shia. And that there's basically just no stopping their willingness to wage that, you know, eternal civil war. And after all, the Shia are the majority in Iraq, but what Iraq? There is no Iraq. They're the minority in the Arab lands of Mesopotamia, the Levant, Arabia, where Arabs live.
That's right. And I think on that note, I'm glad you bring that up, because it isn't just the Sunni that are suffering in this whole disaster. That the Shia in the cities that have been taken over are being killed, disappeared, mosques are being destroyed, shrines are being destroyed. This is happening every day now. And meanwhile, ISIS is consolidating control of many of the areas where it has taken over. So this is setting in, and it's looking like nothing, you know, drones, as we know, air power isn't going to get the job done. Apache attack helicopters, drones, Hellfire missiles, that this only makes things worse and gives them more power on the ground. We saw that all through the occupation of Iraq with the U.S. and the Iraqi resistance. Meanwhile, ISIS is now in control of at least 60% of Syrian oil. This just came out publishing Ashraq al-Assad today, that they're consolidating control big time in Syria. So we're looking at funding that is increasing, and they're literally being able to set up the way things are looking, this caliphate. And I bring up the air power farce, because what's going to destabilize them? What's going to push them back from wherever they came from? Well, it's certainly looking like nothing short of a full-scale ground war is going to get the job done. And who's going to do that? You know, literally, that's an open-ended question. Who's going to do that? Clearly, it's not going to be the so-called Iraqi army. Clearly, politically, the U.S., would they be able to send in tens of thousands of troops to go do this? Politically, I can't see that happening, just as the 2016 presidential campaign is going to start cranking up this fall. Or maybe it will. I don't know, Scott. I mean, what would you think about that?
Well, I mean, go down the list. You know, Margulies was ticking off all the enemies. All the Sunni states, Jordan, Egypt, Saudi, they're scared to death of ISIS, right? The people, you know, may have some sympathy for them, but the government sure as hell don't. Turkey's, you know, Nusra's one thing. ISIS is, you know, too much for the Turks to handle. Obviously, Assad hates them. Maliki hates them. Iran hates them. But out of all of those, who can field an army against them? You said it, USA. And, you know, I'm 1,000% against it. And I think if you just think ahead for a second, you know that anything bad happens to the caliphate that they can blame on America, that just diverts all of their attention from their failed attempt at creating a state into coming here to attack the civilians, as bin Laden put it, that pay the taxes, that support the government that did it to them, just like got us all in this trouble in the first place. But, I mean, I don't know. If the American people, through their Congress, can stop this president or the next one from going in there full scale again to go to war against bin Laden, Stan, or whatever there, I guess I would be amazed. I mean, to me, and this is what I've been saying for months now, is that just play the thought experiment out. Pretend what you said, we don't know for sure yet, right? But pretend what you said is absolute fact that, like, yeah, man, they're pumping oil. They're going to build a bigger and bigger army. They're going to hire more and more bureaucrats to deliver electricity and water to the people and provide security. And they're going to concentrate so hard on building their state. It's going to be successful unless somebody stops them. Who's got the Marines to stop them other than America, that's got an unlimited supply of Marines for just such a thing, and try to do the Anbar Awakening again or whatever it is? And I just don't see a way around it. And in fact, I don't think it's going to wait for Hillary or Jeb or Rand. I think it'll be Obama that does it. I just can't imagine they can wait this long with an actual bin Laden stand there. And boy, I hope I'm wrong about that. I don't want it to be. I'll do anything I can to try to change it. But that's why you're here on the show right now, Dar. But that's what we're headed toward, right? I mean otherwise, like you said, who else is going to field the army to stop them? And how can they politically, I mean, is it really worse politically to send troops there than to just let it be over the long term? I don't know. I just can't see it that way.
Yeah, I don't see It is. It's of course, you know, all of this is with the caveat of how dynamic the situation is, how quickly it's changing on a daily basis.
But, sure, like I was saying, assuming that this is the beginning of their success, you know, something's got to be done according to all conventional wisdom. Anyway, let me keep you another segment here because I talked way too much and I want to ask you more. Is that all right?
Yeah, sure thing, Scott.
Okay, great. Hey, it's the heroic Dar Jamail, author of Beyond the Green Zone and The Will to Resist. He's at truthout.org. Hang tight. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, I'm Scott. Okay, I'm on the line with the heroic Dar Jamail, former unembedded reporter from the Iraq War, now back on the beat for truthout.org. So I was just going off about how, man, I don't know what in the world can possibly stop America from invading ISIS land over here. And yet, actually, I have the best argument against what I just said, Dar. That I want to play for you real quick. The whole clip is 3 minutes and 45 seconds. We're not going to play that much of it, but I want you to hear this. It's Michael Oren, the former Israeli ambassador to the United States up through last October, I believe, and Jeffrey Goldberg, former prison guard in the occupied territories and writer for The Atlantic who helped lie into war at The New Yorker back in 2002. And anyway, so here they are talking about the current Sunni-Shia civil war split. And then I will finally shut up and let Dar Jamail have your ear for a second here. It's Michael Oren and Jeffrey Goldberg. Oh, now they're going to give me dead air for a second here.
If Maliki doesn't stay in there for another couple more weeks, what do you think your country's doing in order to protect your interests? Mm-hmm. And how are you working to align with other partners?
All right, remember, keep in mind, I don't speak for the government anymore. I'm speaking for me and Jeff.
No, you're not.
And what I'm going to say is harsh, perhaps a little edgy. But if we have to choose the lesser of evils here, the lesser evil is the Sunnis over the Shiites. For the reason
I
mentioned
before. You're not speaking for me.
Okay, it's a lesser evil. It's an evil, believe me, it's a terrible evil. Again, they've just taken out 1,700 former Iraqi soldiers and shot them in a field. But who are they fighting against? They're fighting against the proxy with Iran that's complicit in the murder of 160,000 people in Syria. You can just, you know, do the math. And again, one side is armed with suicide bombers and rockets. The other side has access to military nuclear capabilities. So from Israel's perspective, you know, if someone's got, if there's got to be an evil that's going to prevail, you know, let the Sunni evil prevail. And I, again, I'm speaking entirely for myself. As the Sykes-Picot
from the Israeli perspective, my own view. There you have it. Between Al Qaeda, you know, the butchers of New York, and Iran, and or Iraq, and or Syria, and or Hezbollah, all of whom are friends with Iran, which is Israel's nuisance, I guess, not really enemy, but problem that they've made for themselves, at least. The West ought to prioritize the war against Iran, not against Al-Qaeda. And you see Goldberg is saying, hey, don't put those words in my mouth. But it sure seems to me like if there's one thing that is keeping us from going to full-scale war against the Islamic State, it's that three-quarters of D.C. are all traitors who put Israel first, and Israel still prefers war for the bin Ladenites against the likes of Assad and Hezbollah. What do you think, Dar?
It's an interesting point. I mean, it could possibly explain as to why the U.S. hasn't rushed in there and started sending a lot more troops and preparing for the ground war that would be necessary to destabilize ISIS in both Iraq and Syria. But it's, I don't know. I mean, at the same time, I just saw that Israel has accused ISIS of being in Gaza and firing rockets into Israel from there. So, you know, the demonization continues. But it's, you know, the thing is, what makes this so interesting to me now is the just total incoherence of really most governments, well, namely the U.S., about how to deal with it and where they stand. They have literally created the nightmare that was fabricated by the Bush administration, one of the nightmares used to justify the invasion and occupation. And now, hey, here it is. This exists. I mean, Bush, I'm sure, and his cronies would have been praying for this to exist in reality before the invasion took place. And now here it is, and the U.S. is, because of the abject failure of the invasion and occupation, are really over the barrel when it comes to how are they going to deal with this? What are they going to do? There's no political support really among vast majority of the American public for going back in there. And but at the same time, something does have to be done. Are they going to just let this exist? I mean, I can't see that as a viable option anywhere. So something is going to have to be done, but what is it? Because I certainly wouldn't support U.S. troops going back in to do this. But what is going to happen is that really is the question. And the reality is, for the Iraqi people, attacking ISIS and going in there is going to make them strong if that was the course the U.S. was going to choose. It's going to feed them. It's going to draw in more recruits, just like, because, you know, one could, I think, even possibly argue ISIS exists as a result of U.S. presence in Iraq over all those years and the brutality that was meted out throughout the occupation. So it is a world-class conundrum, and I don't know that I have any answers really to date beyond the U.S. The first step should be is stop fueling the fire of dumping money and arms into rebels in Syria, because, of course, ISIS is getting strength from that. And certainly Maliki, who never should have been brought into power in the first place, has to go. So those are the two steps I think that at least could be done, not to necessarily solve the problem, but at least to mitigate it somewhat.
Yeah. Although, all right, so now on the question of replacing Maliki, we got Alawi, we got Chalabi, and, you know, I don't know if you saw the thing by Spencer Ackerman yesterday who said Chalabi's primary sponsor in Baghdad, this is no surprise, but I don't know if you saw, is General Soleimani of the Quds Force, of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards. He's backing Chalabi, I guess, supposedly even more than he's backing al-Mahdi from the Supreme Islamic Council. But anyway, any of these guys, Mahdi, Alawi, this, that, E, and the others, which of any of them all combined together could ever reach the benchmarks of 07 that they never could reach back then and say to the Sunni tribes, listen, we're going to share with you so much power that you'll be happy to turn on ISIS and get rid of them and reconstitute the state formerly known as Iraq. I mean, we're way off into fantasy land here thinking that anybody could reunite Iraq at this point. Am I crazy? Maybe I'm the one who doesn't know what he's talking about.
No, yeah, all of that is, you know, I'm just thinking of a multiple choice test question. You know, is there F, none of the above? I mean, there are no good replacements. I mean, certainly it's a positive gesture to get rid of Maliki. That would certainly not hurt. This guy is a despot. He's been out of control from day one, and certainly all the Sunnis want him gone. But you know, what is the replacement? I mean, again, I don't have an answer to this. Yeah. I mean, he has to go, but what are you going to replace him with? Any of the people you just mentioned? A resounding hell no. I mean, all of them would be different kinds of, just basically different flavored disasters.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like there was a time where, you know, regardless of all the horror that had taken place or whatever, where maybe putting Alawi back in could have led to enough reconciliation, sharing of power, something. As crazy as that sounds, a Shiite Baathist who used to work for Saddam and then for the CIA and was the sock puppet dictator for a year under Bremer and all of that, or after Bremer, supposedly all that. But it did seem like he sort of was able to form some kind of consensus, but he wasn't able to form enough consensus to actually get the chair, so he never got a chance to try. But when they say maybe Chalabi could get it done, I love this. Paul Wolfowitz is in Bloomberg News saying, you know, after everything, and I disapprove of his ties with Iran, but I think Chalabi still might be the best option we have. And then it comes out the next day, yeah, it's General Soleimani of the Quds Force who's backing Chalabi. This guy Wolfowitz, man, he can't stop getting it wrong about this guy.
Well, of course the neocons are going to back Chalabi. I mean, he was their man from the beginning, and he's still the one guy in there, I'm sure, willing to play ball with him where everyone else wouldn't. So, of course, they're going to stick with him. But another point about Alloway, and I absolutely in no way support this guy whatsoever. He is nothing more than a sock puppet. But it is also important to note that in the first election against Maliki, Alloway actually beat him. Actually, he actually had more votes, but it was because of the U.S. insistence that Maliki stayed in.
Yep. All right. Well, listen, I've already kept you over time. Thanks so much. And I'll look forward. Make sure I'm on your mailing list or whatever it is, and that I get your new article when it hits truthout.org. Would you, Dar?
Will do, Scott. Thanks for having me, man.
I sure appreciate it. Everybody, that's the heroic Dar Jamail. He's at truthout.org. He wrote Beyond the Green Zone and The Will to Resist. And we'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you.
All right, y'all. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. So, yeah, the updates on Iraq. It's all bad news. 53 blindfolded bodies dumped in Iraqi Shiite village in Babil province. ISIS fights its way into army base northeast of Baghdad. Government insists base isn't lost yet, so I guess it's lost yet. That many more trucks and tanks and weapons in their hands. As Shiite militias hit Iraq's front lines, their death toll rises. With army in shambles, Iraq relies on volunteer fighters. The entire project of building up the Iraqi army is over. It's done. Oh, but you think the Afghan one is going to stand. Yeah, anyway, so there is no Iraqi army, or just barely. And I guess when the Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani said, young fighting-age males, go join the army, they kind of all went, what army? And instead joined the Badr Brigade and the Mahdi Army and the, what you call it, al-Haq. I always forget the beginning of that. And anyway, so you see how there's no reconciliation between ISIS and the Mahdi army. If the Shiite and Sunni political leaders, the old men with the power, were ever going to be able to come to some kind of understanding, it would have been in the past few years in the parliament. Those days are over now. The whole thing's over. There is no Iraq anymore. And I don't know how anybody's going to put it together again. It's the War of Three Kings. That's what Mitchell Prothero from McClatchy calls it. He's up there in Erbil in Kurdistan. And he's saying, look, the fight, as Dar was just describing it, the relationship between Baghdad and Erbil, or whatever, the Kurdish leadership, it's broken. It's not being put back together. For example, the Kurds are going to make their own damn oil deals, and Baghdad isn't going to have a say in it at all. They will forsake their share of profits from Basra oil in order that they can just do it themselves. And so they don't need Iraq. They don't need the Baghdad government. And they're already telling them to go to hell. That relationship, you know, they could be friends again, but it seems like northern Kurdistan, I mean, they're holding a referendum, so it's basically a done deal that Kurdistan is gone. That dispute is intractable there. That's how it will be solved, is independence. And then, you know, I don't know, these ISIS guys, they're on a roll right now, but as Coburn was saying yesterday on the show, there's still just maybe a couple of 10,000 guys, more likely about 10,000 guys. That's not that many. But then again, they've been pretty successful so far, and they've got the oil. And as Prothero reported, the kooks have made an alliance with some very powerful Ba'athist generals who are, you know, at least somewhat competent. You know, you guys might believe in God a lot, but that doesn't mean you know anything about military strategy. So how about you boys start taking orders from people who actually know how to fight? You know, flanking maneuver Delta, go now kind of thing. The ISIS guys don't know that stuff. The Ba'athists do. Fighting an insurgency is one thing. Fighting as a state, fighting in a real war. I mean, they were risking fighting a real war against the Iraqi army before it just completely melted, fell apart in front of them. Again, no mystery why. You know, Maliki says, oh, it was a conspiracy against him and all of this kind of crap. People, you know, treason, Ba'athists had infiltrated the army and all that. No, it's just the army always was just the Ba'ath Brigade, and Mosul ain't their territory. Under severe attack, there's no reason to think that they would hold that territory. Same as in Fallujah. When they're really challenged, they just leave. That ain't their town. And so, you know, withdrawing back to Baghdad, that's one thing. Now, them falling apart completely, that just goes to show how hollow the whole force was. And Patrick Coburn explains it. The Iraqi army is just a racket. It always ever was just a racket for the officers to make money. There never really was much of an army in the first place. Whole thing was a joke. And I'm sorry, I mean, it may have cost your son. I don't mean a joke like ha-ha. I just mean, it wasn't ever true that that was the solution to America's problems in Iraq. Train up an army for the people. Just remember, the whole time they pretended that this was a war for the people of Iraq so that they can have a democracy, rather than this is a fight for one side against the other, for the Shia majority against the Sunnis. That was what it was from 2003 on. And they never were honest about that the whole war. You know, I still think about the letters I got from U.S. Army guys who would write emails to antiwar.com saying, how can you guys stab us in the back like this? We're out here fighting, and you're sitting here talking about we're doing a bad job. When we're here trying to give a democracy to these people, trying to help save them from the terror and whatever. And I would say what you're doing is you're fighting for the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution and the Ba'ath Brigade and their allies in the Dawah Party and Muqtada al-Sadr and his Mahdi army against the former Ba'athists and the other Sunni tribal leaders and all that. And they would say, if they answered after that, they would say, oh, well, I guess I really don't know about the Supreme Islamic Council. You know, all they know is the mantras that their commanding officers, you know, gave them to regurgitate. Same as the American people were watching on TV. Freedom and democracy for the Iraqis. And yeah, it's true that there were, you know, local Iraqis outside of power, Sunni and Shia. They got along just fine, like Catholics and Protestants in your neighborhood here in America, where people don't care about that stuff. The Hundred Years' War was a long time ago, blah, blah, blah. But the power factions are still all defined by who's who. And so, there you had it. I mean, the Ba'ath Party was basically entirely Sunni. Obviously, the entire Wahhabi, Salafist, Takfiri, blah, 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 Bin Ladenite movement, that's exclusively Sunni on their side. And then on the Shia side, it was the Supreme Islamic Council, Dawah, and the Mahdi Army, and they're all exclusively Shiite groups. And so there were some who tried to put together coalitions, but as Dar said, all the people who wanted to put together coalitions were the ones who wanted to kick the Americans out, too. And so America backed, who'd they back? They backed the guys who were way more pro-Iran than they were ever pro-us. And what was their plan? Always to take Baghdad and everything to the south and east of that. Strong federalism, the Supreme Islamic Council called it. And so it was the Iranian plan was to break Iraq up all along. I mean, what kind of nightmare? Imagine being the Ayatollah and the Committee of Mullahs of Iran and going, well, obviously we want Shiistan to be under our influence, not necessarily a province of Iran, but very closely held, you know? But who the hell among the Iranian military and, you know, foreign policy establishment, such as it is, would want to try to rule Mosul into Crete and Fallujah and all the Sunni triangle forever. Forget that. I mean, what's the point? Just let that go. And that was what Sauder was always denouncing, was the Americans were backing, really, the Iranians who were trying to break Iraq up. The same ones who told America, thanks for winning the war for us against the Sunnis, now go to hell and get the hell out of our country. And turned around and kicked us out after fighting the war for them. So the whole damn war led to this crisis. It's just a, I don't know, man. You know, to hear Dar say the level of fear among the Sunnis that are still in Baghdad is to the level of 06. I mean, geez, I don't know. If I had feelings, I guess I would feel really bad reading that, you know? That's really bad. And, you know, the lines are already drawn. The East already has, you know, run off with Iran. The West and the Northwest, obviously Kurdistan's already de facto independent, soon to be de jure, and the Islamic State, the Sunni tribes allowing ISIS to declare this Islamic State, whatever, is basically just their declaration of independence from the rest of Iraq, their separation. And there's still maybe hundreds of thousands left to die because they're stuck on the wrong sides of the lines. But I doubt the lines are going to move very much from where they are now. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, you guys, welcome back. Later on, we'll talk about the police state. And also, we'll talk about what's going on in Palestine. I'm waiting for Jason. I don't want to be too redundant. Jason Ditz, news editor at antiwar.com, is going to be on. We're going to ask him all about what's going on in Palestine. Did I say Ukraine? I'm going to talk about Ukraine. Oh, I got to talk about Iran. All right, so there's a lot to talk about, and Jason Ditz coming up on the show. Speaking of Jason Ditz, here he is. From July 8th, 1,000-strong Syrian rebel brigade defects to ISIS. Free Syrian army rebels demand U.S. arms threaten to quit war. The Syrian Duwad Brigade, a 1,000-strong group of fighters formerly allied to the Islamic Front umbrella, has left its position in the Idlib province and gone to Raqqa to join ISIS. The brigade brought with it 100 vehicles, including 10 tanks, seized from the Syrian army during various battles, and is the largest defection so far to ISIS from any rival rebel faction. The Islamic Front's sham army, the sham army, which I always thought that just meant that they're al-Nusra guys who rebranded, you know, four of them, the sham army, or those, they had another name than that had sham in it somewhere, I don't know. They're the ones that Mitchell Prothero was saying. They're the ones who've been getting the Saudi funding more than anybody. But they're basically the go-betweens between al-Nusra and the Americans. Anyway, the Islamic Front's Sham Army Wing downplayed the reports of defection and insisted they had expelled Dawood, believing them to be a fifth column for ISIS. That seems unlikely with the faction bringing such a large amount of vehicles and weapons with them, yeah. But does reflect growing acrimony between ISIS and the Islamic Front, which is claimed to have executed ISIS fighters in recent days. The FSA, the pro-US rebel faction, seems to be trying to capitalize on fear of the ISIS takeover of Syria, and some of their fighters are demanding that the US dramatically increase their weapons shipments, saying they will stop fighting ISIS and potentially quit the war entirely if the U.S. does not pony up increased aid. I think Patrick Coburn was being as wry and sarcastic as he can be, saying, listen, if you really want to fight ISIS in Syria, wasn't it Coburn that said, what you do is you team up. Maybe it wasn't Coburn who said this. He's never this sarcastic, is he? You got to team up with Assad and the FSA. If you're so moderate, then you'll work under Assad to get rid of ISIS and push them all where? Into Iraq? Where they can be bad guys instead of being good guys here? Anyway. And this is only one of many, many reports of, you know, the al-Nusra Front and some of the different militias fighting in Syria. There are a lot of small groups spread out. And so, you know, just because one changes sides doesn't mean they all do, but many of them have been changing sides. I mean, what do you expect them to do? They're going with the winner. They're going with the guys who have erased the border, at least for the time being, perhaps forever, between Iraq and Syria. And so, anyway, there you go. I've been saying this for years. Anybody who's been listening to the show all along could tell you. I've been saying for years and years and years how it makes no sense whatsoever. Or it makes sense from an evil and cynical point of view. But it is clearly the wrong thing to be fighting to limit the ability of Assad to keep al-Qaeda down in Syria. If America has any interest over there, it's in keeping al-Qaeda down. And I'm not saying that America should back Assad, but we sure as hell should not be backing revolution against him this whole time. And same thing for Libya, too. I tried to tell you. No, he listens to me. I don't know. But anyway. And now here, this thing is just spreading because it's just an idea. I've been telling you this for 10 damn years, that you're turning al-Qaeda from a small group to a major movement to, you know, a set of goals, basically, that young men can subscribe to. And so it doesn't matter whether this new kook group cropping up in Lebanon saying, oh yeah, we're ISIS too. It doesn't matter whether they've ever met anybody who's ever met Baghdadi in their life, right? All they have to do is say, yeah, that's like us. We're loyal to that same group of goals too. It's like opening up a new Burger King franchise or something. And there's no copyright there to stop them. I mean, I guess they can get their heads cut off if they start representing the larger movement wrong. But, well, then again, this guy, Bakr Baghdadi, broke from Zawahiri and sure did get away with it so far. Anyway. Here's my thing. I can't help but ignore the fact that Iran is not America's enemy. They're really not. They're a strategic rival if your strategy is dominating someone else's region on the planet. But they're no enemy state of the United States. It's arguable that they were behind the barracks bombing in 83 or whatever. That, of course, they do arm Hamas, the democratically elected government of the Gaza Strip, according to the elections that Condoleezza Rice and Ehud Olmert held for them back in 2006. And so whatever, they back. Okay, so Hamas is a terrorist group, but they're not an enemy of America. Neither is Hezbollah an enemy of America. They're both really, you know, statelets. They're pseudo-states in southern Lebanon and in the Gaza Strip there. And, of course, in Gaza, under Israeli occupation. And right now, a rain of fire and death from the sky, of course, too. But Iran is no enemy of America. I mean, they don't do a thing to impede our shipping through the Gulf. They've been saying for a long time, lift the sanctions, let's do business. They've been saying for a long time, let's negotiate on the nuclear issue. The deal that they're working on trying to get done now is the same deal that they could have had back in 2005 before the Iranians ever even started installing centrifuges at Natanz, before calm was a glimmer in their eye. And so anyway, it's madness, this Michael Oren policy that he's again stated. I told you about this starting last fall. the article in Ynet News where Michael Oren is saying he's the former Israeli ambassador to the United States. He's saying, listen, in a fight in Syria between these bad guys and those bad guys, Al-Qaeda versus Hezbollah, which is, of course, backing Assad's government there, hey, I choose these bad guys. Because those bad guys, if I got my these and those right, I forget. Those bad guys, Hezbollah and Assad, they're backed by Iran. So as long as these bad guys are opposing those bad guys, I'm for these bad guys. That makes perfect sense, I guess, if you put Israel first. But for the American government to side with bin Ladenites, for example, the Al-Nusra Front, the Islamic Front, and formerly ISIS, all are sworn to bin Laden and Zawahiri. To choose them against Assad and Hezbollah simply because they're backed by Iran is high treason. It's treason. And I guess if you want to argue whether it's treason for Israel or if it's treason for Al-Qaeda, I don't care. Either way, it's treason for Barack Obama and for his government to do what they've been doing and backing the rebels in Syria this whole time. We've all known this whole time. You can Google David Sanger at the New York Times and Jody the Tool at the Washington Post. All of them. Everybody in major media all agree. American money and weapons have been going to ISIS this whole time. Have helped lead us to this point. American political insistence that nobody deal with Assad. Assad must go first. Has made it this way. Has led to this. Hey, Al Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. Coming up in just a few minutes, Jason Ditz will be here to talk about Israel-Palestine. All right. So, look, if you go back to the merger of the Azzam Group and Egyptian Islamic Jihad into Al-Qaeda in the 1990s, and Osama bin Laden's declaration of war against the Jews and Crusaders, as he put it, in 1996, and then followed up with another fatwa just like it in 98. First of all, the gripes are American occupation of Saudi Arabia and military bases, combat forces, boots on the ground, on the Arabian Peninsula, land of the two holy sites of Mecca and Medina, birthplaces of Islam. Also, support for Israel and their permanent occupations of Palestine, and at that time, southern Lebanon as well, had been going on for 15, 20 years, right? Then there's the support for all the local dictatorships, like the Saudis, Mubarak, the Hashemite Kingdom in Jordan, etc. Pressure on those governments to set the oil price where we want it. Oh, see, I left off. I'm sorry. In order should have been using the bases in Saudi Arabia to bomb and blockade the people of Iraq and kill a million of them in the entire war of Bill Clinton against Iraq in the 1990s. Was also, that would have been second on the list. Then Israel, then support for the dictators, then making those dictators set the price of oil where they want it and waste all the money on coke and whores and American debt when it should go to lift up the people of the region, he argued. And American, he calls it support, and I guess this is arguable in different circumstances, but in bin Laden's fatwa, he argues American support and at the very least blind eye and silence when it comes to Russia, China, and India in their wars against Muslims, which he said was the proof that America doesn't care about human rights. America cares only about their own interests, and if their own interests have Muslims in the way, then they'll destroy all Islam if they have to get what it is that they want, he argued. And notice that when the Russians, the Chinese, and the Indians commit war crimes against the Muslims, the Americans have nothing to say about it. In fact, this is trivia right now because the guy who's just become the new president, or I'm sorry, maybe prime minister, I think president of, or no, I guess prime minister, I forget, y'all, it doesn't matter, of India, he's from the BJP, right-wing nationalist fascist party in India. Oh, they're the true Aryans, don't you know? And they, his particular group, and in fact, he just appointed the guy who ran the whole thing, but it was his group and his guy he just appointed who ran a pogrom that killed, I think it was 20,000 Muslims in retaliation for supposedly an Indian Muslim had attacked and killed two or three Hindus. And so in retaliation, they killed 20,000 people. And this was just after September 11th and the war in late 2001 or maybe early 2002. And the Americans didn't say a thing about it to the Indians. And as Michael Scheuer pointed out, Bin Laden and Zawahiri and whoever it was put out a statement saying, see, the Indians killed 20,000 Muslim civilians and the Americans don't say a word about it. They don't care about freedom. They don't care about human rights. Give us a break, Al-Qaeda said quite credibly. So there are the gripes, and then so what are the goals? The goals were not to scare you away. The goals were all the way through, from 1993 all the way through, because they saw it as America was already at war with them. America's the far enemy, the evil money, you know, deep pockets behind every dictator in the region. The only way to get to win their local revolutions is to get rid of us first. And the only way to get rid of us first, it's a long-term chess game. The only way to get rid of us first is to attack us, to lure us in, to bog us down in the sands of Afghanistan, to snipe down at our guys from the mountaintops until we finally go bankrupt and have to leave just like the Russians. And that was the plan. And then, as Michael Scheuer put it, the invasion of Iraq and the rest of the entire Middle East policy since then has been nothing but the hoped for and absolutely unexpected gift to Bin Laden, because it accomplished everything that he wanted. Not only bankrupt the American empire and over the long term make it impossible for us to back the local dictatorships around there, but also radicalize an entire generation against America specifically and their American-backed sock puppet dictatorships, which has worked in spades, witness the Arab Spring. And in fact, just all the money spent helped destabilize, because when America inflates our currency, the whole world has to match it in order to keep the trade balances in line and all that. So the price inflation hit the Egyptians right in the stomach when their $2 a day that they're living on became worth 50 cents or a dollar. And they went out to riot and protest and overthrow Mubarak and the rest of the Arab Spring. All that destabilization radicalized everybody. And then the elections in Egypt, which were canceled then by the military dictatorship backed by the United States, only proved, and Zawahiri mocked America a year ago, only proved that they were right all along, that America will never let the Islamists win. Look at Algeria 93, look at Gaza 06, look at Egypt 11 and 12. America will cancel any election that doesn't go their way in the Middle East. And so any Islamist is a fool to go along with the Americans and their, you know, British style parliamentary democracy systems and the rest of this crap. And so America has just done nothing but, oh, and overthrew the socialist infidel Saddam Hussein. Again, those are Osama bin Laden's words. Continue working to weaken Assad, who had been keeping a lid on the bin Ladenites in Syria. Continue fighting with Iran, which is what they want more than anything, is a regime change. Well, not more than anything, other than a regime change in Saudi Arabia. Bin Laden always would, of course, love to have seen the overthrow of the mullahs in Persia. And so America continues to accomplish every single one of Bin Laden's goals for him. And he mocked the American position in 2004 in his reelect George W. Bush speech. He says straight to the American people, listen, they're taking advantage of this situation in a way that only benefits a few connected companies and that kind of thing. But it's at your expense, everybody, and you're only doing what I want you to do. He said, all I have to do is send a piece of cloth upon which it is written Al-Qaeda to the furthest point east, and you'll send all your generals and your billions of dollars racing to go and fight it until finally you are shipwrecked and destroyed and my people went out. And he didn't ever really want to be king anyway. That's the only part of it that didn't come true, but he never really wanted to be the Sultan. He knew he was going to die in this thing. He's probably amazed he got to live, you know, hiding in an attic up until 2011. But here's a guy who's wounded three times in battle. As Michael Scheuer said, slept on the floor of the cave. That's why he had respect. He didn't have respect because he had money. He had the respect of the people around him because he slept on the ground like they did. And he knew this was all just a strategy, right? It's like George Kennan saying, here's what you got, or Chalmers Johnson saying, here's what you guys should do, and then dying or whatever, right? Just advice. I don't mean to compare Bin Laden to Chalmers Johnson. You understand what I'm trying to say. He wasn't even really trying to be the guy at the end that ruled the caliphate. I guess he probably would have preferred it that way. But that was the last and least of his goals. And America and George W. Bush and Barack Obama and their governments have accomplished beyond Bin Laden's wildest dreams. Overthrowing Saddam for him, overthrowing Gaddafi for him, overthrowing Assad for him. Turning the entire western, northwestern part of Iraq into Jihadistan? Are you kidding? Thank you, Bush and Obama, says Osama from his watery grave.
Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about commodity discs from commoditydiscs.com. They're 1 ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the backside. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code commodity disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one free. That's commoditydiscs.com.
All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm on Liberty Radio Network and scotthorton.org. And hey, join up the chat room. We got a good little crew going on in the chat room today. Not that they're saying that much. scotthorton.org/chat. And by the way, if you want to advertise on the show, you should email me, scott@scotthorton.org, and we can work something out and you can advertise and maybe we'll make some money. Sound good? scott@scotthorton.org. Keep forgetting to say that, but just now I remembered. All right. Next up is our good friend Jason Ditz. He is the news editor at antiwar.com, news.antiwar.com. Welcome back, Jason. How are you?
I'm doing good, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing real good. What a bunch of bad news. All right. So I guess the most important question that I can come up with to be my first one is, what's with the land invasion of the Gaza Strip? Truly imminent or bluff?
I think very probably imminent. It doesn't seem like there's much pressure against it. I mean, the U.S. has said they hope Israel can avoid it, but they certainly don't seem like they're going to put any real pressure on Israel not to do it, and they're loudly endorsing the airstrikes. Prime Minister Netanyahu says he feels no pressure to stop the attack, so I think we're seeing escalation now for the foreseeable future.
And so far, it's just airstrikes, though.
Yeah.
I saw where they had warned the people of Gaza, get back. What are they supposed to do, just go drown themselves in the sea? Get back. We're about to invade you. And by the way, I'm not sure if it's my headset. Let me see here. Yeah, Jason, you got, I'm not sure why, but you got quite a bit of background noise there. I'm not sure if there's anything you could do about it to get away what may be causing it.
I'm not hearing anything. I'm not sure.
All right. You don't live right next to the freeway or something?
No.
Air conditioner blowing right on your microphone?
Maybe. Let me.
It doesn't really sound like an air conditioner. It
move over
like
a little bit.
Let's see.
Is that better?
No, not much. But you know what? I don't care.
Okay.
I just like listening to you, man. Everybody else does too. It'll be fun. All right. So now, how many killed so far in the air raids on Gaza, Jason?
Well, it's at least 100, and it's still rising. We don't have the exact figures at any given time.
All right. Well, now, obviously, according to, I don't know who wrote the rules, but the rules say that if you're Hamas, then your life is forfeit, so they don't count. But what about the others, the civilians in the Gaza Strip? Can you give us a ballpark at least on the percentages there or the numbers?
Unfortunately, it's really hard to tell at this point. Israel insists everyone they kill is Hamas, of course, but from what we've been hearing out of the hospitals, the majority are not Hamas. There have been at least 21 children as of last night. I haven't seen new figures for the children death toll this morning, but a lot of women, children, and the elderly are getting killed when they're hitting seemingly random houses in residential areas. So certainly more than 50% are civilians, but any more than that, it would just be a guess.
Yeah. Well, and I don't know if you saw this one yet today, but did you see the picture of the Israelis from Sederot? Is that how you say it? Where they're just brought their lawn chairs up to the hilltop to watch the fireworks show, applauding whenever blasts are seen and heard.
Yeah, that's pretty common in these Gaza flare-ups. You know, since Hamas took over the Gaza Strip in June of 2007, this is the seventh time we've seen something like this. I mean, not all of them have been as big as this one. Some of them, of course, like the 2008-2009 one, were bigger. But, I mean, the Hamas rockets are such a minimal threat that, yeah, people really don't feel like they're putting themselves in any real danger to go up on the hilltop overlooking Gaza and just sort of watch the show.
Right. But meanwhile, oh, boo-hoo for every single Israeli, the terror that they live under, that, you know, the kidnapped prisoner in the basement is trying to get out. It's so unfair to them all. But meanwhile, nah, they can just sit on the hillside and watch it for fun, smoke a joint,
yeah,
listen to the radio.
It's incredible. And I mean, we had our first real Israeli casualties today when one of Hamas's, I hesitate to even call them rockets because they're really just chunks of pipe that they lob in the general direction of some city. Half the time they bounce off somebody's roof and do a little superficial damage to the building. But one of them actually hit a gas station and caused 7 injuries. I don't know how serious the injuries were, but those were really the first meaningful casualties on the Israeli side of the war.
Yeah, it's amazing the way the government spins that. That here, these people are basically just making, as you're saying, what you can barely even call a rocket in their garage. And the fact that they're using them is proof that they're just randomly targeting civilians, because they can't possibly target anything with them at all, and it doesn't even matter that no civilians are dying of it. But meanwhile, why, Israel, they use laser pointers and all their sophisticated stuff as they're tearing little babies apart with their 500-pound bombs that they drop on people's houses. But, oh, they're abiding so carefully by the rules of engagement. Sometimes they drop a bomb with the warhead not activated just to let you know they're about to destroy your house before they destroy your house, which is so humanitarian of them.
Yeah,
saw that emphasized on CNN
earlier. I was
reading
a story about that where they were talking about dropping the sort of smaller warning bomb.
Yeah, they're calling it the knock on the door or something, warning.
And, I mean, these bombs are so much bigger and so much more powerful than Hamas's quote-unquote rockets. I mean, the warning bombs are liable to kill more people than Hamas is over the course of this.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you this, Jason. I'm not very good necessarily at telling what other people think, but you're exposed to so much media all the time doing what you do for antiwar.com. And I wonder whether you would agree with me that the average person is probably under the impression from the news that Palestine somehow or another, is the state next door. Whether or not we're still working on a two-state solution or not is kind of beside the point. But they really don't understand that there is an occupation, that these people are already occupied, conquered. The war was already lost by them back 40 years ago, and they're under this permanent martial law occupation. Do the American people, are they exposed to that part of the story at all, that we really are talking about the fight between the guy upstairs and the prisoner in the basement rather than two neighbors?
I don't think they are. Certainly, I mean, we haven't seen much discussion of, if you watch television news, of the Palestinian casualties at all. Most of the focus is on Israelis in bomb shelters. And, you know, during the kidnapping with the three Israeli teens and then the subsequent killing of the Palestinian teen, there was really, it really was treated like the West Bank is just the country next door, not an occupied territory.
Yeah, Rand Paul called them, Israel's Palestinian neighbors. Like, this is just another incursion over the line, you know, like it's Germany and France, you know, rather than an occupied territory. It seems like that to me is that's what makes me actually hopeful about the situation, is it seems like if the American people could ever be made to understand what's going on with just the basic facts of who's occupying who, that their opinions would change, to a great degree, the way that they interpret this stuff. I mean, for me, when I see the Israeli spin on this, it's just absolutely laughable and ridiculous, and I think it, for anyone who knows anything about it, really, it comes across that same way. I'm hopeful that that's true. Anyway, hang tight, Jason. Hang tight, everybody. We'll be right back with the great Jason Ditz, news.antiwar.com, in just a minute. Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the thing here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm on the line with Jason Ditz. He's the news editor at antiwar.com. That's news.antiwar.com. What was it you said, Jason? 100 and how many Gazans killed so far here?
Well, at least 100. We don't have the most current figures coming out of Gaza. Like, every few hours it gets updated.
Now you sound even worse, all feedbacky and things like that.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on with your phone, dude. I think it's you, though, not me. I could be wrong.
You want me to try a different phone?
Well, wait a minute. What if I go like this? Is that a little bit better?
I don't know. You sound the same either way.
Yeah. Okay. You know what? I think that might have fixed it. Maybe it was me. I turned up my aux too high, man. All right. Well, anyway, we'll persevere. We'll get through. It's Jason Ditz, news.antiwar.com. So I'm looking here at Gaza bombardment further traumatizes children suffering from PTSD. And this is because not only are they under, you know, severe bombardment now, but they live under drones all day, every day in Gaza. I don't know exactly what's to come of this generation of children, but they're not going to be right in the head. And, you know, that's a big part of this, right? It's not just the people who are blown apart, but everyone else who has, you know, absolute reason to fear that they could be next, and no reason not to, right? In Israel, if you're running around in circles hiding from Hamas rockets right now, well, then you're ridiculous. You're actually not in danger. But each and every Gazan is in equal danger of getting blown up at any time at what must seem to them pretty much like random. I imagine really living like that, bombs falling out of the sky in your neighborhood. It's crazy.
Yeah, and it really does seem like it's pretty much at random. I mean, Israel, of course, claims to have all sorts of intelligence that they're basing these attacks on, but from the outside perspective, it certainly doesn't seem like they're hitting anything meaningful. And from the Palestinian perspective, it's probably even less apparent what they're trying to accomplish when they're just blowing up random houses.
Yeah. And now, let me ask you, what do you know about the mobs in Jerusalem running around chanting death to the Arabs and checking drivers' identity cards to see, God, like it's a rack or something? Is that getting worse, or is that now kind of winding down? Has anybody else been lynched, or what is going on?
So far as I know, no one else has been lynched. It's sort of hard to tell whether that's getting worse or better, or if the Israeli military is just censoring it more strictly, because we're not seeing a lot of new reports of that over the last few days, and there have been some reports that the military censors are making it a lot harder to get any information out of the West Bank or out of East Jerusalem as far as protests or anything like that.
Yeah, no First Amendment there. They can just put down a gag order, and they can literally lock Israeli journalists in prison for talking about what they don't want talked about.
Oh, right, and we've seen that a lot of times in the past where the Israeli media will sit on a well-known important story for months because the military just won't let them publish it, and then finally it'll get leaked to some Western paper, and then they'll lift the gag order.
That's a crazy situation. And now, I guess, I don't know, maybe I'll ask you about the Iran talks. It's something that I don't know if there's really any news to cover other than they're still meeting. I want to believe in this so damn bad, Jason, not just because I'm so sick and tired of the Iranian fake nuclear issue as a big fake issue, but because I think I have one good reason to believe that the president really wants to do this, and it's so someone anywhere will ever have anything good to say about him or anything that he ever did with his life or his presidency. He's got to have one thing. How about the beginning of detente with Iran? It's right here in his grasp. All he has to do is not be an idiot and accept whatever deal, because they're not making nukes anyway. So tell me it's going to work out by the end of the month.
By the end of the month, it's not going to work out. I'm still hopeful that they'll eventually come to a deal. But the idea that they're going to come up with a deal by that July 20th sort of soft deadline when the six-month interim deal expires, there's no way. They're so far apart on centrifuge numbers right now. The last I saw, Iran has about 20,000 centrifuges operating.
Mm-hmm.
20,000, well, equivalent of what they're considering base centrifuges for this negotiation purposes. The United States is pushing for the final deal to allow them to keep 10,000. So they want them to cut in half the program that's pretty small, realistically. I mean, that sounds like a big number, but it's really not.
Yeah.
Well, Iran was looking to expand that program so they could be self-sufficient powering the Bushehr power plant, and they're saying they need the equivalent of 190,000 just to power that one plant.
Oh, well, I don't know if that's really right, but I don't know if it isn't really, I guess. But still, I mean, obviously their plan, as they've stated all along, is to have more and more power plants into the future, too, not just to Bushehr. So.
Right. They're negotiating with Russia right now on the possibility of expanding Bushehr and building 5 or 6 more power plants across the nation.
So am I right then, Jason, that the American position is the way to solve the problem that they could make nukes soon is to limit that number of centrifuges? And their answer is, no, we want our centrifuges, but the way we'll limit the ability that has you so scared to make nukes that we don't want to make anyway is we'll go ahead and oxidize all of our uranium hexafluoride gas and put it all into fuel plates, kind of immediately, so that there's really no risk that we can weaponize any of our safeguarded, verified nuclear material, because we'll be putting it to use or putting it putting it in process for use immediately upon enrichment up to 3.5%. Do I have that right? Or I know that that's Gareth Porter's journalism, but is that what they're saying about the talks now, that these are the two different positions and that somehow they got to reconcile the two?
Right. That's basically it.
So Gareth really did get that scoop. I knew it was right, but still, it's nice to have it confirmed.
The stockpile that Iran had of uranium is basically gone at this point. It's all been converted into fuel.
It already has, you're saying.
Well, all of the 20% is gone that they were using for the Tehran Research Reactor for the medical isotopes. That's all converted to fuel rods now. And a good chunk of the stockpile of 3.5% has been converted, too. So that stockpile that, you know, Israel was constantly presenting this as a red line. Once the stockpile gets to X amount, we're going to have to start an immediate war. Mm-hmm. It never got to that amount. And, in fact, it's been continually shrinking to the point where it's a fraction of what it was when the six-month deal started.
Well, and that's... Yeah, exactly. That was what did it, right? Was as soon as they started the interim deal, they started immediately doing, as promised, that was part of the interim deal, was that they were going to go ahead and, you know, render all that uranium hexafluoride gas into uranium oxide powder for use for fuel plates and all that. And they've just been nonstop, you know, charging down that path ever since.
All right.
So... you know, if you need any indication whether they really mean to continue following that path after the separate deal, sure sounds good. You know, Gareth was saying, you know, come on, the breakout scenario that they're going to say, get out of our country, IAEA, we're making nukes now. That was always the most ridiculous, stupid fantasy that couldn't possibly be real. And the so-called sneak out, where they're going to somehow divert nuclear material that the IAEA never knows about in the first place, or misses that it's being diverted, and have some entirely separate, secret, clandestine nuclear weapons program. That's just as fanciful. Both of these are ridiculous comic book type situations. The only two paths to a bomb, one or the other. Neither of them could possibly be, or, you know, only in the most ridiculous circumstances that only America could make, probably. You know,
right.
Otherwise,
even
it's ridiculous.
Even when Iran was expanding their enrichment program, there's such a heavy level of spying on Iran that it was getting leaked to the media before Iran had even been required to publicly inform the IAEA about building new facilities, that there were facilities being built.
Right. All right, well, listen, man, thank you so much for all the great work that you do, Jason, and your time on the show again. I sure appreciate it.
Sure, I hope the audio quality wasn't too bad.
No, it's just fine. Thanks again.
Sure, thanks for having me.
All right, that's the great Jason Ditz, news.antiwar.com, the best of the best there. See y'all next week.